Pushkin.
Small business owners, this one's for you. Chase for Business and iHeart bring you a new podcast series called The Unshakeables. This one-of-a-kind series will shine the spotlight on small business owners like you who faced a do-or-die moment that ultimately made their business what it is today. Learn more at chase.com/business/podcast. Chase, make more of what's yours. Chase Mobile App is available for select mobile devices. Message and data rates may apply. JPMorgan Chase Bank, N.A., member FDIC. Copyright 2024, JPMorgan Chase & Company. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey everyone, this week's special episode of Talk Easy is supported by Mubi, a curated online cinema streaming a selection of exceptional films from around the globe. Each day, Mubi introduces a new hand-picked gem, and you have 1 month to watch it. Whether it's a timeless classic, a brand new festival favorite, or a critically acclaimed masterpiece, there's always a perfectly curated selection of films to discover. Try it free for 30 days at Mubi.com/talkeasy. Welcome to the show. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso, and this is a special episode of the podcast. For those who have not listened before, I assure you what you're about to hear is not exactly what happens on a week-to-week basis. Usually we have one guest come on, and then that guest and I talk about anything and everything, whatever they want to talk about. But Corey and I were going back and forth and trying to figure out how to end this year on a note that was somewhat vaguely positive. I'm not sure we exactly succeeded, but in trying to do so, we called up a bunch of people who came on the podcast throughout this year, some of whom we got on the phone, some of whom just left voicemails, and we asked each of them to talk about a piece of art or pieces of art that inspired them or that they fell in love with or just that kept them going in 2016. On either side of the aisle, I imagine, the last couple months have been confusing. I think that's a fair adjective. Some may describe it as scary. Some may say they're fearful. Some may be uncertain how we continue onward in 2017. I certainly don't have the answers to it, and I'm not sure anyone we called up on the phone has the exact answers for how that works. But we talked, and it was really great to catch up with a bunch of people on the holiday and have them talk about the things that made them happy this year. It's hard sometimes when you're feeling despondent, or maybe this is just me, but it's hard to feel hopeful when so much is not hopeful, when so much feels sad and frustrating and scary. But we tried our best throughout all these calls to remain positive. I don't know how well we succeeded. I think that's going to be for you guys to judge. I'll say more in the outro, but thank you so much for listening to the show. If you've been listening, and or even if this is the first time or you've just started listening, thank you for doing that. And I hope your holidays are going well. We're going to start off with a call from our friend Matt Zollersites, who wrote the Oliver Stone Experience this year, the TV collection book, which you should buy. He's also the editor-in-chief of RogerEbert.com. When I called him, he was out last-minute shopping, as many of us, I imagine, were. And it was a fun talk about TV and film and his children. So, yeah, I hope you enjoy this talk with Matt and the other folks that came on. And I'll say some more later. Okay, here's Matt Sides.
Hello?
Hey.
Hey, how are you?
I'm good. How's the Christmas shopping going?
It's really, really intense because it's Manhattan at Christmas time and there's tourists everywhere and there's people doing last-minute shopping.
Hmm.
And so it's an obstacle course.
There's by
you got to be super alert.
You mean by there's people? You mean you're doing last minute shopping, right?
No, not me. Heavens, no. I'm above that sort of thing. No, I'm kidding. No, I'm buying some last minute stuff. I have a lot of family members staying with me for Christmas, and many of them are children. So,
well, speaking of presents, in the most forced segue ever.
Yes.
Art this year. There were some good things in a year that was historically, I think, not great for most people.
that's a nice way of putting it.
I'm trying to be diplomatic. So what happened this year in art that you discovered or something that moved you that you fell in love with?
There was a lot of stuff. I really don't like to say that, you know, such and such a year was a good year for movies or a good year for television or
right.
a bad year, because I just don't think there's any objective way to measure that. And I think what it means when people say it is, I saw a lot of stuff I liked this year or I didn't see a lot of stuff that I liked. I think that's all it means, because there's like literally thousands of films released every year and like tens of thousands of hours of television. And how can you possibly say it was a bad year unless you saw all of it? And no one could see all of it.
Every year can be good depending on how much you take in.
Every year. And like when I'm in a particularly snarky mood, when I hear people say, oh, this was a bad year for movies, it's like, what you mean is you didn't see as many movies as you should have.
Yeah. But I mean, was there something in television, especially since you've been writing about it, that you were like, oh man, this feels game changing and revolutionary?
Well, I will say that this was without a doubt an extraordinary year for scripted television in terms of quality. And I've been writing about television for over 20 years, and I've been watching television since I was a little kid. And this is by far the best year I've ever seen for comedies and sitcoms. Like nothing else has even really comes close.
Hmm.
Just the sheer number of things that were out there that were worth seeing and having an opinion on, even if you didn't like it, they were worth seeing, was phenomenal. And I sat down to make my top 10 list, and my preliminary top 10 list had like 37 titles on it, and I had barely even started.
Wow.
And the list was so, there were so many good things that, you know, I could probably struggle to remember exactly what I put on my top 10 list, but I might accidentally substitute some other things that almost made the cut because, like, depending on what week you ask me, my list is going to be different. But
great, by the way.
It is great. And the People versus O.J. Simpson,
mm-hmm.
And O.J. Made in America, and the television series version of The Girlfriend Experience, which was completely different from the movie. Wow, that was great.
It was
and,
incredible.
And Atlanta. The Donald Glover's series Atlanta was, you know, every you can't throw a rock at television without hitting a sitcom that wants to be Louie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there's like probably a dozen TV shows on the air right now that on some level want to be Louie. Like they're taking the lessons of Louie. It's like I could do that, and I'll do my own thing with Louie.
Right.
But of all the sitcoms that I think would not exist without Louie, Atlanta is the one that I think surpassed it. Like in its first season, I think the first season of Atlanta. Almost every episode of that thing is better than all but the best episodes of Louie. And its time slot partner, Better Things, which is by Pamela Adlon, who was a co-star and co-producer and co-writer on Louie, was also outstanding in its first year. I thought The Americans had its best year ever. Better Call Saul, I thought, was phenomenal. I thought Queen Sugar, Ava DuVernay's series, was terrific. And then there were a lot of just regular old kind of traditional three-camera sitcoms I thought were very good this year. I thought Blackish was phenomenal. The Carmichael Show, The Goldbergs, I love that show. Like, that's a show that almost never makes anybody's top 10 list because it doesn't have anything on its mind but being silly and making you laugh and being touching. And every episode
I love that you love
same.
That show.
It's funny. It's funny as shit, man. It's really, really a funny show. And you know, it's one of those shows that just, like, you know, it's a classical, it's a repository of all the classical virtues of three-camera. I mean, it's a one-camera show, but it's really, like, rooted in the three-camera sort of humor tradition. Everything's very broad, you know? It's like, it's almost like you're watching a little play, it's great, and they almost make a fetish of the fact that, like, you could say, like, well, every episode's the same. It's like, yeah, every episode is the same, right down to the structure, and they even end with a heartwarming music montage set to some 80s song that probably would have scored a heartbreaking music montage in a movie in the 80s. They love it, and they're winking at you as they do it.
I think there's a reason for this, that you love it especially, and this is something to consider versus maybe most TV critics or film critics.
Yeah,
is that you're a dad?
Well, that's possible, but I also love. Well, you know, okay, there's different ways to be a parent and love shows about parenting. Mm-hmm. I love The Goldbergs because it captures all of the positive feelings, like the best case scenario of being a parent. But I love Better Things because Better Things is the dark side.
Mm.
You know, she loves her kids on that show. She really loves her kids. She would, like, give her life for her kids without hesitation. But there are also many points during the show where it looks like she would also like to strangle them.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, like, there's, like, the sort of the resentment of the responsibility of having kids is also the subject of Better Things. And I can't think of another sitcom that went there so fearlessly as that show. It's great. I mean, there was just so much good stuff. I mean, it was such a good year that things like Mr. Robot and Westworld, which did not make my top 10 or probably even my top 20. If this were 10 years ago and shows of that level of ambition were on the air, I think I probably would have put them on the top 10 list. You know, whatever misgivings I had about them, because they were just they were swinging for the fences in their own way. And then movies, I don't even know where to begin with the movies. I saw so many great movies this year. Tony Erdman was great. Fences, I thought, was terrific. I really hope that people give Fences its due. I think there's a tendency among my colleagues to write off things like that as being quote-unquote Oscar bait. And I've already seen some people complaining that it's not sufficiently cinematic, and I really have no idea what that means, because I thought it's one of the greatest adaptations of a play that I've ever seen for the movies, and if you see it on a big screen as I did, oh boy, is it cinematic. Like, they've really split the difference between being in a big Broadway theater seeing a play and watching a movie.
Number two on your list, you had Patterson as number two.
Patterson was fantastic. I was completely unprepared for how much I loved that movie. And I started laughing. Like, you know me, I never laugh like derisively. I always laugh because I'm delighted by something.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not always because something is funny. It's because, like, there's an appropriate choice or a surprising choice that's been made. And I was laughing my ass off all through Patterson because they kept doing things that just seemed so completely counterintuitive. Like, you're not supposed to make movies like that where everybody's nice to each other and everybody's, you know, everybody is basically decent at heart. And when the chips are down, they come through. And
it almost feels like I thought it was going to be like a dystopic land that it was set in. Like, I was convinced at one point it was going to take a turn because it was so eerily kind.
Yes, I kept thinking that too. And also, there were many points in the movie where a lot of independent films that you would watch that had this setting and this particular set of characters would take a turn for the dark at some point. Like, it's like he's going to hit somebody with his bus, or somebody's going to have a heart attack on his bus, or his bus is going to catch on fire, or his girlfriend's going to get, you know, mugged, or, you know, some kind of, like, indie film thing would happen, you know, or it's going to turn out she's a heroin addict You know, like decades of really terrible American independent films have conditioned me to expect to, you know, the other shoe to drop at some point, and it never did. And there's a point where he's driving his bus, and there's a technical malfunction on the bus, and it's like, okay, here it comes. He's going to go off a bridge, and everybody's going to die. And it's like, no. He pulls over, he calls it in, he tells everybody, another bus will be along in about 9 minutes. And, like, that's it. It's funny. I just love that he's, you know, this is a movie, basically, it's about a guy who's essentially happy.
In the absence of, like, the anger or the outburst or some tragedy, it's just poetry. Like, they just keep going back to poetry, and it's like, man, life could be pretty nice.
It can be pretty nice, and I also appreciated the fact that it's a story about a guy who's supposed to be talented at whatever art he practices, and then you see, they give you examples of his work, and it's actually good.
Yeah, it's actually good.
You know, think about how many times you've seen a movie where it's like, he's the greatest saxophone player of our time, and then you hear him play, and you're like, eh, he's all right. You know, this was some quality poetry. This was really good. And I was watching it with a couple of friends of mine who are, you know, good poets themselves. They were like, dude, this is good poetry.
I'll ask you this, cause you got to go and I have to go do more Christmas shopping. The year is coming to an end. I don't know. You're not a particularly nostalgic person, but I want to ask you, how are you feeling about the end of this year and the start of a new year and everything that has happened in the last 12 months in your life?
Well, I had a very good year professionally. I did a lot of work that I was proud of. I had two books come out, TV the Book and The Oliver Stone Experience. And I think in different ways, I think they're about as good as they could be. Hmm. You know, like I can see how I could have done both of them differently, but not necessarily better, which is a sign that, you know, I should be satisfied with the result. And I'm starting work on my second feature film. I haven't done one in 10 years, and this one's going to be really, really fun. It's a science fiction movie with puppets. And so that's all great. I don't think the country did so well. I mean, 27% of the population voted for Donald Trump, and another 28% voted for Hillary Clinton, and the Electoral College worked out in favor of Trump, which sucks. And then there's 48, something like how, whatever that percentage is that's left over of the population didn't vote.
Hmm.
They didn't vote at all. And who knows how things would have gone if those people had voted. And now we got to live with the consequences here. And things are pretty dire, man. They're pretty dire, I got to say. And the only, I guess it's, I don't know if it's a silver lining or not, but I have a lot of friends overseas, and almost all of them have lived under circumstances similar to the ones that we're about to go into, with an authoritarian who has no respect for law or tradition being in charge of the country. And it's not good. You know, you survive it. Most people survive it. There may be some casualties, but my friends in, you know, Brazil and the Philippines and Chile are going like, all right, I'm really sorry that you have to find out what this is like, but let me know if you need any advice. and I don't have a whole lot of patience for people who say, well, the next 4 years are going to be great for the arts, because, you know, a lot of great art has been made during dark times. It's like, yeah, but if you kind of do your research on that, you find out that most of the art that was made during dark times was made by people who had escaped. You know, like, you don't, you know, people who were living during the siege of Aleppo weren't cranking out beautiful paintings and working on their novel. They were too busy trying not to die.
Right.
You know, it's only with tranquility and some kind of comfort that you can collect your thoughts enough as an artist to make any kind of a coherent statement. So, you know, I think people who are comfortable might make some interesting art, but I think the most interesting art about this period isn't going to appear for 8 to 12 years. And in the meantime, I just hope that I hope that people don't get too used to this.
Here's the one thing I'll say is that we're going to keep at it, I think, and we're not going to remain docile, and that's what we have to do, and we're going to continue. I mean, especially you know, you're going to continue working and doing the best you can.
Yeah, well, that's certainly true. You know, up to the point where up to the point where it becomes impossible, and hopefully we won't reach that point. But, you know, I just want anybody listening to this to be aware of how easy it is to get used to things that you never would have thought you could tolerate. You know, the human race has an infinite capacity to adapt and tell themselves that things are normal when, in fact, they're, you know, unacceptable. And I hope we don't get to that point. I mean, that's a kind of a bleak note. That's kind of a bleak note to end on. But
it is a bleak note to end on. But you know what, Matt? It's okay, because it's a good reminder. And I appreciate you doing this. And I will talk to you next year.
Take care, Sam.
So long, bye. Matt. Bye-bye.
Hello, Sam. Bill and Turner here.
Hey.
We are here to talk about some things that brought us joy in 2016.
Big year.
Off the top of my head, I'd say the NBA Dunk Contest brought me a lot of joy. Blood Orange album gave me a lot of joy.
Yeah, Blood Orange, meeting some of the folks doing contemporary color, new music test. That was pretty remarkable.
This year we shot a film about James Baldwin. Had the good fortune of that. And in doing research for that, we got much more familiar with his work, which helped
helped cope with current events, both positive and negative. And great voice from another generation, but very pertinent to now.
Let's talk about Floyd. Let's talk about Floyd. I think Floyd speaks to what we're trying to pull off right now. And
specifically Dusty and Sweets McGee, definitely.
Aloha, Bobby and Rose. Two films from the 70s that are somewhere in between fact and fiction. Both set in L.A. and really capture the light of that time.
Just loose.
They're very loose. They're imperfect films. But there is something going on in both of those films that is...
They're kind of perfectly imperfect in terms of tone.
Yeah, they're alive. They're alive. You feel like you're in L.A. at that time. And they really, yeah, they really, really inspired us this year going into the project that we're venturing into at the moment.
I'd also say that, yeah, you're right on with Hail Caesar. Hail Caesar was certainly that. I mean, what I got out of it was just, I mean, even though that's in line with some things that we'd had, you know, had conversation about, it's still these vignettes that make up sense of place and just masterfully done. I thought that was an incredible film.
That was good. It doesn't, I don't know, didn't seem like it really struck a nerve, but... that might be the film that I watched most this year.
Yeah, fuck them. I mean, that was awesome. Being able to use that as a device, being able to use that studio system as a device to bounce around and just see these different set pieces of that era and also get behind that. Yeah, I thought that was so cool. So well done. Oh, started watching Atlanta. I know you're far ahead of that, on me, but everybody been talking about that one. I'm on board, man.
How many episodes are you in?
Just the first couple. I think it's awesome.
It is so good.
What the hell is going on there?
It's so good.
Yeah, I was not prepared for that. I was not prepared for that voice. That is not what I was anticipating, and I am sucked in, man.
Yeah, it's so cinematic. It feels big, you know. It's not what I was expecting either, but I can't wait to rewatch it. Those characters are so vivid and fun and complex. It's
and who's Paperboy's sidekick? Oh my god, man!
What is that dude's name? Yeah, I just
hey
I,
man, can I measure your tree?
That was the best. That was easily the best. And I can't speak, I don't have a whole lot of knowledge of what was on the tube this year, but that was one thing I sat down and watched. And,
that was pretty boss.
Oh my god, I could talk about that for days, but I imagine that's probably way up there on everybody's list.
I'm sure we were Sarah and I were coming off a much more serious-toned viewing of Westworld, which I don't think you've seen.
I tried to watch one episode and just... I don't think it's quite my thing.
So I read all those Michael Crichton books when we were kids, and it's you know, it was the film that Michael Crichton wrote and directed, and but then became this series, and it has that thing that must be embedded in my child brain, which is build wild institution. Institution goes wrong. Man questions self in the universe. And I don't know. I dig it, man.
That's all his. All his.
It's
all
the
his...
formula for all of them. But yeah, it's still. I like questioning. Questioning self in the universe.
Yeah.
There was this podcast.
Not to be too cheeky, but I think I have listened to every episode of Talk Easy since we've been on it, and it's a fine, fine program, Sam, and you should be very proud of yourself. I'm only saying this in the hopes that you'll have us on again. I'm kidding. It is, you know, you get deep with folks, and that is a rare quality. I listen to it each week. It's good.
Every once in a while, you ought to let people dig back. Appreciate you, brother.
Yeah. So, yeah, there's some rambling stuff there, but thanks, buddy, and we'll see you soon.
Next up on the podcast is the actress Mackenzie Davis. She was in this really great Black Mirror episode. She's in the new Blade Runner film, and she's also in this great movie that came out this year called Always Shine, which, if you have not seen it, should be on your year-end list. It's playing in select theaters around the country and should be available on Amazon Prime within the next couple months or so. We spoke a couple days ago. She's talking about this book she discovered when she was abroad, and it was the thing that kind of got her through 2016, as art sometimes has the power to do. So hope you enjoy it. Here is Mackenzie Davis. So, Mackenzie, what piece of art did you fall in love with this year?
Well, I feel a little bit embarrassed saying this because I have talked to you about this and it sounds like I only read one book this year and just keep using it as conversational fodder.
It's okay.
But I really, I read In the Dark Room by Susan Faludi, which I found when I was in Budapest for 2 months working, and I was feeling kind of lonely, and I just couldn't. There's something about Budapest that was so beautiful that I just couldn't connect with it, and I didn't understand why, and I kept trying to figure out why I couldn't connect with it. So I went to this bookstore and bought a couple books by Hungarian authors, and I knew Susan Faludi is an American author, but her father is Hungarian, and it's a memoir about him coming out to her in his 70s that was a trans woman and changed her name to Stephanie. And she was a very absent father when Susan Faludi was growing up, and then sort of wanted to reassert her identity in this new form to her. And I don't know, the book it's really, really interesting. It's about just identity and the different identities that we prioritize at different times in our life. I mean, her father's identity as a Jew, as a Hungarian, as a man, and then as a woman, and on all of these different selves that he or she later on in her life identified as, and when in our lives certain identities are more relevant to us than others. And it was a really good lens to learn about Hungary and a whole history that I didn't know about. And I just loved it. And that's the book I'm always talking about.
Well, what's interesting is that it's now in my possession because, for people listening, Mackenzie thinks it apparently somewhat relates to my life.
Because you were talking about your parents and about like accepting the identities of your parents, and Susan Faludi's father was a really bad father when she was growing up. He was like hyper masculine in this like adopted American male way, really violent, like sort of terrorized her family and totally abandoned them, and then came back into her life as this different person, not just in her identity as a woman, but as a totally different version of the person that she grew up with. And she's so graceful and I don't know, sort of unbelievably accepting of some harder parts of her father's personality, and I don't know why I told you you should read it. I think I just liked the book and was trying to find a way to manipulate everyone around me into thinking that it would be particularly relevant to their life.
You know what? I think it is. So for the record, because I know my dad's listening, he's a very nice dad, and there was no beating, mm-hmm. there was no any of that. But I think you're probably on to something about accepting parents for who they are. But what I was going to ask you is, did it feel like the book seemed particularly timely for you this year? Like, the conversation about transgender has especially been something people have been talking about. And that's why I'm most fascinated by the book.
Maybe less in the specifics of, like, a gender identity and more... I mean, I really used it as a lens to learn about Hungary, to be honest. Mm. And because Hungary has had so many shifting identities over the past, I don't know, I mean, hundreds of years, but especially in the last 150 years. And it's been sort of shuffled about, and its borders have been redrawn so many times, and it's had to rearticulate its own national identity. And I'm very interested in how countries create an identity for themselves and sort of mythologize themselves, especially if that myth doesn't, it's sort of like a state sponsored effort. Mm. I mean, it really felt timely for me to be in Budapest and feeling sort of alienated and trying to understand this place a little bit more. So yeah, but I feel like you have a deeper question that I'm not answering.
No, you answered it. You're talking about the shifting identity. I did one of these right before I called you, and my friend Matt Zollersites, and
cool,
yeah, he's a really great guy. But we ended up just, and I wanted to pose this to you, is like, this, you know, the prompt for this, it was like, it's been a historically not great year, I think, for most people, mm-hmm. and mm-hmm. you're talking about Hungary shifting identity. I think that very easily could apply to us. And I guess I'm wondering, how are you feeling about the end of this year, the start of the new one, and all that's happened to you in the last 12 months?
Bad. I don't know. I do think that I read this book when I was still absorbing news. I was in Europe and I was absorbing news about Trump and the election with the same sort of, it almost felt like gossip to me this year. Like, I used to follow politics in a way that made me feel informed and like I was, you know, engaging in some system. And this year I felt really, I don't know, like I was just had like an addiction to Us Weekly or something. Like, I just couldn't stop reading it because it was so tawdry all the time.
Right.
And I read this book at that time. And then thinking about it now, and thinking about Hungary's own history in relation to what is about to become a very tumultuous period of national identity for America, it has a much greater weight, and it feels a lot scarier. Just how quickly things can get out of control. How quickly, like, fascism can take hold by just, like, testing the borders of what people will accept over and over again, and they get a couple yeses, and then suddenly, I don't know, the whole country has agreed to put Jews in a ghetto in the middle of the city. It's just a really, that sounds extremely alarmist, but it also feels like we're in a phase right now where we're being tested for how much we'll allow, for what's acceptable, what like crosses our personal barometers of ethics.
Yeah, Matt was talking about this exact. I don't think you're being alarmist. He took it to this exact same thing of how much mm-hmm. are we willing to accept, and how much are we saying this is okay, and.
Yeah, the hardest thing has been, and this has happened all year, and I think was so instrumental in getting. Not getting Trump elected, but in things not sticking to him, is just the sheer volume of like ethical atrocities that we were bearing witness to. Mm-hmm. That we couldn't hold on to something long enough to let it become like the end of his momentum or the end of anything. Right. And that was how it felt in the campaign, that there was always something new to talk about. And it feels like that now, like with appointing his cabinet, with his business interests, with everything that comes out is similarly so alarming. But instead of it not stopping his momentum as president, it's like preventing us from, I don't know, really holding on to a single issue and getting behind it. And I don't know, he's not even president yet. Jesus.
That's the most terrifying thing, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
I guess it's funny. Matt and I arrived at the same place of we both have to go, and we ended on a very sad note. And I'm trying to.
I know, but it's hard to do a wrap up of 2016 and be like, well, I just can't wait until the dawn rises on January 1st and we get to really dig our feet in again. It's just been hard. It's just all been really sad. I feel like I grew up a lot this year in ways that, are very real.
That's what I've heard from everyone that I've talked to, and off the podcast, on the podcast, is like, everyone feels like they've aged like 10 years in terms of like mental, I don't know, sort of mental stability, but also just a lot. I can't even imagine what was happening in March earlier this year. I don't know. I have no idea what was happening.
No, it was still fun to watch.
It was still fun to watch.
Yeah, I feel like I aged, like my worldview became really realistic in a way, or dark maybe, in a way that it never had before. And I feel like I was so naive before.
This is going to sound ridiculous and maybe overly sentimental, but I'm going to say it, that the one thing that I've felt throughout this year, the one thing that I've felt throughout this year that has been nice, I feel like I've met a lot of new people, and I feel like I've made new friends, but also the new relationships have fueled me in like the absolute darkest of times that we've all been living in. Cause I always think, well, you know, at least I have good people around me. And,
I don't think that's too sentimental.
And that you're, you know, that's you. I mean, I met you like 2 months ago, like 3 months. I mean, so I'm thankful for
and
that.
And we're already friends. You know, same. I'm really happy to be friends too. Yeah. I think it's good to find things that we can be overly sentimental about, because it's really easy to feel, like everything is a catastrophe.
That's true. So I guess thank you for that.
Thank you. Have a great time home with your family, and happy holidays.
Thank you, Mackenzie. So long.
Okay. Bye.
My favorite thing this year, I guess artistic, is this book that my friend Porter gave me. We were both at this art colony in New Hampshire, and when he was leaving, he gave me this book called A Field Guide to Getting Lost by Rebecca Solnit. And it was all like dog-eared, and I mean, obviously he, you know, really marked it up, and he gave it to me because, you know, I was getting, I guess, a little bit where I couldn't think sometime. And I would then, with the book, it sort of opened me up creatively, and I would wake up in the morning and read a chapter, and then I could more easily write. And then I really wanted to keep the book. I thought probably the right spirit would be to give the book to somebody else, but I haven't really been able to do that. So instead, I bought a bunch of copies of the book and just gave it to a bunch of other artists I know and kind of passed it forward.
Hey there, Sam. Hey, Talk Easy. This is Max Linsky, and the piece of art that will stick with me from 2016 is the album Farewell Starlight, with an exclamation point on the end. It's by the band Francis and the Lights. I should disclose I have like zero objectivity on this matter. Francis Starlight is someone I've known for a long time, and I got to know him through Aaron Lammer, who is my partner on Longform and who is in the band and who wrote many of the songs. And the album's just, I don't know, it's special, and it feels honest. I think it feels honest if you don't know them, but if you do know Francis and Aaron. It feels particularly honest. And I don't know, I listened to it 1,000 times, maybe 2,000 times. The best track is probably Friends, but See Her Out is the first song on the album. Also, We'll Stick With You. You know, the whole thing will stick with you. It'll stick to your ribs, and it's certainly going to stick to mine.
Hey everyone, putting a pause on this holiday special here for a second. If you noticed, the last few episodes of this podcast have been supported by Mubi. For my money, even before they started supporting and sponsoring the show, it was the best place, and still is, to discover new films and to really expand your cinematic horizons. Especially for people like me, where I don't really know like where to go. Like, you see the IMDb list, you have your friends who recommend stuff, yes. But it's a lot easier when things are curated for you. And they have a great team over there. One thing that's playing right now, if you're trying to watch something that's not like It's a Wonderful Life or A Christmas Story or sort of the traditional holiday fare, you could check out No Country for Old Men. When was the last time you watched that great, great film by the Coen brothers? It is an incredible, profound, admittedly very dark piece of work, and maybe it is fitting to cap off this year. I don't know, but it's streaming now on Mubi.com. And rewatching it, which I did about like a month and a half ago before they had it on there, it's astonishing how well that film has held up. As much as I remember the dog-eat-dog world of Cormac McCarthy, the can, or whatever the hell he's using as a weapon to kill someone, the sort of sordid affairs that everyone is getting themselves into, there is a beautiful, unexpected poetry to that movie, as a lot of Coen Brothers films have. So if you have the free time over this holiday break, maybe check out No Country for Old Men. There's also a lot of other stuff playing, including Target, or maybe an 80s midnight double bill with Starstruck or Forbidden Zone. There's a lot going on at Mubi, and you can check it out for free for 30 days at Mubi.com/talkeasy. Now, here's a voicemail from Melanie Linsky.
My favorite piece of art from this year was the book Commonwealth by Ann Patchett. This novel is one that I know I'm going to want to read again and again in my life. It's so perfect. There is a climactic emotional moment in it. For anyone who's read it, it's near the end of the chapter at the Zen Center. And I cried so hard when I finished this one passage that I just was shaking and sobbing. I mean, this book moved me like I can't even explain. It's sprawling. I think it covers 5 decades in the life of this one extended family, but it's so intimate. You get to know these people incredibly well. And it's just, it's so perfectly written. My heart was broken when it ended. And I also felt so full of life and so in love with this book and so in love with books. So yeah, this year wasn't all bad because of this perfect book. I really, really recommend it.
Next up is our pal, Wesley Morris. He came on, I think it was episode 4 of the podcast back when we launched in April. He is the critic at large at the New York Times Magazine, a job they quite literally invented for him when he got there. A fact he doesn't like recognizing or talking about, but it is a significant one. He also used to write at the Boston Globe, where he won a Pulitzer Prize, and Grantland when that was still alive and thriving. In this quick conversation we had, we talked about the directors he felt were emerging this year in cinema, and the ones that he thinks shape the future of where movies are going. So I hope you enjoy this quick talk with Wesley Morris.
Hello.
Hey.
Hey.
How are you, Wesley?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm ready to go home. I'm ready to be with family, I think. Yeah.
Oh, well, congratulations, because...
Yeah.
I don't know how that works. Ready?
Well, you know, I like being cooked for and having food and, you know.
All right, I accept all of that. That all sounds fine.
What are you doing? Where are you going?
I am going to San Francisco.
Oh, okay.
For like 3 days, and then I'm going to deal with my family.
Okay. So you're.
I'm more like coming back to. They're going to be in my house when I get here, which is going to be interesting.
Oh God, why are you letting that happen?
Listen, the alternative is to be here the whole time.
So, because of that,
I love my family. Listen, I love my family.
The record states that, but you're fleeing to San Francisco, and then you're having your family stay at your house while you're not there, and then spending some time with them.
Yeah, it's fine. It's totally fine. Nobody cares.
Okay.
And they'll you know, I put a tree up. I'm going to let them decorate it since I never have a tree.
Oh, wow.
I was given specific instructions about what it means to celebrate Christmas with my two nieces and nephew.
What does it mean?
It means having a tree for babies to put gifts under.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the extent of it.
Did you get like gifts?
Oh yeah, there are gifts and everything. I you know, I'm not crazy, but okay. The babies need gifts because they're not really babies. They're old enough to know that somebody didn't get them something for Christmas.
Right.
So that's one thing. Then the other thing is I kind of have gotten reasonably okay at giving gifts to children. I don't get offended when the kids don't play with anything and there's no ego involved in their appreciation of it. They're children. Who cares? But every once in a while, you strike gold and the parents don't care and the kids like it.
And they're as happy as they've ever been, which I think is the most exciting part.
Not with my gifts, really, because they're, you know, the parents' gifts are always the best gifts, frankly. I mean, at least in my... and my experience with both giving gifts to children and receiving gifts from children. If you get a gift from your parents.
Are you giving them books?
Why? Is that a bad gift?
I mean, it depends how old they are, but it's almost never a good idea to give a kid a book unless they're very bookish.
Now, there are some things that you just you don't do. Like you don't give certain women kitchen appliances. You don't give certain kids books. You don't give... certain men exercise equipment or like workout gear.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like stuff you don't do. So, no, I did not give the children books this year.
Oh, this year. Oh, so it's a thing you have done.
I learned.
Yeah. Okay. You saw the sort of mild enthusiasm I had for the books.
No, zero. When they're kids, what mild enthusiasm? They're like, what the fuck is this?
I don't know. When you were given books as a kid, I bet you were kind of excited.
I never got books as a gift, actually. Okay. I mean, because I was always being given books in other capacities, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I don't recall getting books for Christmas. I mean, we didn't get a lot. I mean, I remember toys were like, you know, I mean, like any kid, like you want a toy.
Yeah.
That's what you most want.
You want a toy. And then it's a bummer when the toys no longer seem, they no longer work. And then your parents.
Where are you going?
I'm going to Fresno. And then a little bit, I may go to San Francisco next week for a couple days. And then going to Vegas for one day.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
What's Vegas for one day about?
Friend is turning 21. And I think we just like the movie Swingers too much. And so we're just going to go and try it. I've never gone to Vegas over the age of 21.
That'll be interesting for you.
Yeah.
Or not.
I like to gamble.
Kind of, okay. Well, then never mind. You're doing the right thing then.
Do you hate it?
I've never had the adult Vegas experience, to be honest with you.
Oh, okay.
I've been told by many people who've been and love it, adult people, that it is fun and special. Funny that I've never heard a woman say that. Like, I've never heard a woman come back and be like, I loved it. Although that's not true. I think my friend Juliet was in Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
I should ask her about that. But she's one of the few people. I also have a friend who grew up in Reno. Uh-huh. So, you know, one of my best friends is from there, and her relationship to Las Vegas is also different.
It should be remembered, Wesley, that I'm only kind of an adult. So, you know, who knows about my enjoyment there?
Well, let's see. I mean, you're enough of an adult to not get arrested for anything, right? I mean, for being underage anyway. I mean, you can get arrested for all kinds of shit in Vegas, but...
Yeah, that's a pretty low bar for adulthood. Just
you're legally an adult.
Yeah, I'm legally an adult. That's true.
So let's do this. I got to get in a car.
Okay, let's do it. So the prompt, it wasn't really a prompt, but something or someone you loved in art this year, and you have a whole host of people.
I just, I gave you a bunch of names, but I mean, really, it's just an idea that, you know, a lot of these people are young, and the people who aren't that young, everybody on that list of people is their careers are young.
Mm-hmm. So you have Trey Schultz, and then so that's his first film or second film?
His first feature.
First feature, and then Barry Jenkins.
Yeah, and I'm not going to remember everybody. I think Ezra Edelman. It's his first sort of, well, it's not his first movie, but his career as a filmmaker is young.
Mm-hmm. Andrea,
OJ, The People Versus. Oh, I mean, he didn't make The People Versus OJ Simpson. He made OJ Made in America.
Mm-hmm. Can we say definitively, is that a movie?
That's a movie.
Okay.
It's a movie. This debate is nonsensical. This is like an Academy debate. This is none of my business whether, like, let the Academy, like, fight this out. Like, it's a movie. It not only because it played in movie theaters, and it's still, by the way, playing in movie theaters because it's a movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't see Gilmore Girls playing at the Metrograph in on the Lower East Side. I'm just saying. and Marin Ade, who made, did you see that movie?
Tony Erdman?
Yeah.
I did, yeah. Yeah, I did.
I think she's incredible.
She's incredible. Yeah, she's incredible. Is that one of your favorites of the year?
Yes. It's one of those, it's an acquired taste even as you watch it. It's not like it gets better the second time you see it. I mean, it does, but it also gets better the first time you watch it and you understand what this woman's rhythms are, mm-hmm. and what this movie is about. And it's just, I love a director who is entirely comfortable with weirdness and not feeling like she has to do, because, you know, the things that are weird about this movie are in tension with the things that are utterly normal about it, with human relationships and emotion. And these two people are strange. And I like watching weird behavior in movies.
I like when people are matching strangeness, like one person's strange and then the other person's like just as strange. It's kind of, yeah. It's an interesting dynamic.
Well, in this movie, the daughter learns to be as strange as the father, or discovers that she is as strange as the father.
Right.
Or accepts that she is. I don't know. It's unclear. But I just think this is a special movie that very few people are going to like. But
I actually think, I think you're wrong. I think it's like,
maybe, I hope I'm
wrong.
I
think it kind of has, not.
I already know people who hate it. So,
oh, really?
Yeah.
That's the thing. I know no one who hates it, but then again, everyone who watches it is somewhat in the cinephilia range.
Right. And it hasn't opened yet, so that's another thing.
Okay. Normal people, we'll see how they feel.
Well, civilian moviegoers, I guess, is maybe the better way to put it.
Okay.
But I don't know. I'm curious. I am curious to see how people respond to it. I really like this movie a lot.
Also on this list, you had Andrea Arnold, mm-hmm. on here. What? Are you sure?
About what? About her career being young or her movie being good?
I guess both, but the second part especially.
I really like American Honey. I really do. I think it, I mean, it's got great, I love how she directs actors. Mm-hmm. I love how she uses space in all her movies. I think that the buttons that she pushes can make you roll your eyes. There are things about Fish Tank that I didn't love, for instance, mostly because I felt like she was being very aggressive in her insistence that she had found a world that she could dramatize. But I also think that that relationship between that mother and that daughter is really good. I also think in this movie, I kind of like the way she uses this concept of fraud and theft to get at these other sort of emotional ideas about real feeling and connection. And I think Sasha Lane is just a really interesting and fun person to watch in a movie. And I also happen to feel that Shia LaBeouf is extremely underrated.
I was going to ask you, how are you feeling about him these days?
I've come around to, I think that he's annoying.
You mean like his presence outside of movies?
I think that his idea of himself annoys me. The idea that he is both a serious actor and a living commentary on serious actors.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that he can he can balance those things. And I think that, you know, a person like him and James Franco and Joaquin Phoenix, I think those are three people who you never really know where inside or outside the quotation marks they are.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't always enjoy that, but I do when Shia LaBeouf is engaged with a part and he's got enough to do as he does in this movie, I think he can be really interesting. I think Ryan Gosling is another one of these people where it's, you don't know, they're both so committed and so disconnected from commitment at the same time that you don't know what to take seriously. I actually blame Brad Pitt for that strain of acting more than I do like a handful of other people.
You think the roots are in Brad Pitt?
I think Brad Pitt doesn't get enough credit for being somebody that people don't even know they're emulating, but is like his indifferent application of himself to movies is a style, and he makes like movies sort of look easy by also not necessarily seeming like he has any talent, which is not, you know, that's not the case now.
Yeah,
but,
right.
But there is something interesting about his relaxed, his frequently relaxed approach to being a movie star. I think Allied is a really good example of when that does not work.
Hmm.
Anyway, I really like Andrea Arnold, and I think that she's somebody, anytime she makes a movie, I want to see what it is. I think I'm more interested in her being in this group of people than I am truly in love with American Honey, but I do really like it.
Right. So you think Gosling in La La Land, to talk about Giselle, he fits in that reign of actors who kind of give a shit but don't give a shit?
I think he's over that now. I think he's giving a shit again.
Okay.
I think the problem is that he's now performing not giving a shit as opposed to performing the role of a person who should give a shit but doesn't.
I think
he's just attracted to characters who are – whose coolness comes off as indifference.
Mm. I always feel like that's the thing. I always feel like he's too cool for every role he's playing.
You mean Ryan Gosling, the human being, is too cool for the roles he's taken?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe that's it.
That's a legitimate gripe with Ryan Gosling. I just think he's such a talented – he's so good at being Ryan Gosling I think that it's hard for me to come up with an argument against this iteration of him. I think when he works with Derek Cian France, I think that they're very bad together because he's indulging that aspect of Ryan Gosling versus him working with someone like Damien Chazelle or even in The Big Short, which is not a movie I liked at all. I really liked him in that movie, mostly because he's acknowledging that he's kind of a slickster. But Damien Chazelle's on this list because, I mean, it's a generation of directors that I think are really exciting and interesting. And I think Damien Chazelle is really interesting because he is both making an old type of movie in a deliberately old fashioned sort of way that is also sort of relentlessly new at the same time. These also are weirdly personal movies where he's trying to work something out. And I don't ever think I don't know if he's ever, I mean, I don't know if he's ever really going to work it out. He's a young guy.
He's like 32, I think. Something like
is
that.
Is he that old? I thought he was younger than that.
He may be 29 to 32. I think he's in that range.
He's definitely in that range. I thought he was even younger than 29 though. Okay. Well, I do think he's just extremely talented, and this guy, I don't know where he starts in his creative process, but he really knows how to end a movie.
He does. I think that's the most impressive thing. I'm always interested in filmmakers who know how to begin and end movies, and I think he knows how to
Nobody
do
Nobody does. Very few people do.
It's hard. It's really hard. So you bought into La La Land and the whole, I feel like that's a movie. When I saw that, I'm like, oh, people are going to love this. Like the civilian, what did you call them?
Civilian moviegoers.
Moviegoers, yeah.
We're not civilian moviegoers. We see too many movies to be civilian moviegoers. And have to, like, you know, we're paid to do it. I like most of this movie. Like I said, the things that he's trying to work out, I'm not into. I'm not into them. I just don't feel like he knows what he wants to say about art and creation. But I also like how, I mean, the same was true in Whiplash, which is a movie, you know, which is a movie about, it's not about jazz so much as it is about,
it's a sadistic art. Relationship as well.
Right. Of creation and artistry, I think is more what it is. I don't know. I like what a pragmatist he is, in like the idea that he set this movie in a sort of fantastical realm, which is this sort of French musical, and is committed to these ideas of like what it is to grow up and be an adult and make adult choices, and not all of those choices are fun or romantic or sexy. They're hard and they're boring and they can lead to disappointment and dissatisfaction and disillusionment. And I just can't imagine Spielberg making a movie musical that also is about like just adult emotionalism.
Yeah. I don't see that happening.
Where the production isn't really the star of the movie for Damien Chazelle. It really is these two people.
There's something to it. I mean, he also focuses like that on Whiplash, I think.
Yeah.
On the whole, good year for movies. It's, you know what's been strange? And tell me if you feel this, because I know you got to go. Do you feel like, since our post sort of Trump world we're living in, it has been really hard at this year end to like, this is the time when I generally watch a lot of movies, and I've had a hard time focusing on the stuff that has been coming out.
Oh, interesting. You know who I would add to this list to answer your question? Jeremy Saulnier, if that's how we say his name. The guy who made Green Room and
Blue Ruin.
Yeah. Blue Ruin, yeah. I think that guy is in this class of people. I mean, he's not. I think his interest as a filmmaker is going to keep him in the quote genre arena unquote. But he's as good as everybody else in this list, especially in his sort of embrace of the horror sort of torture genre. And I think that a movie like Green Room is just. It knew, you know, it knew it, even if you, I also think this is true of Deadpool at the other end of the spectrum, but I mean, you know, I feel like they're like that guy knows, he knows other parts of this country that a lot of filmmakers don't, like a lot of coastal.
He was a Washington guy. I think he's from Portland, or he's from some strain, or Seattle maybe, some
is he from Seattle?
I think it's Northwest. Yeah.
I mean, his sensibility is just unlike many other. I mean, that's what's great about this whole list, right? Like all of these sensibilities are completely unique to each other. I mean, Marin Ade is not American at all.
Right.
And it's just great watching all these like ideas about being alive come together in these people's movies. But I don't know. It's a bad year for movies generally. But you anytime you are forced to sit down and like make a list of things you really liked, you can tell yourself a different story. But it was very easy to come up with a list of 15 movies this year and not feel like you had shortchanged anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was a much more interesting year for nonfiction filmmaking and filmmakers than it was for the opposite.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But like I said, I mean, you asked me to do this and I was like, well, what is interesting to me? I think that you have a class of about, you know, anywhere from 7 to 10 filmmakers who are really exciting and probably won't be co-opted by the larger system. I mean, and I think Damien Chazelle is a really good example of somebody who can make a Hollywoodish movie that still feels true to him.
Yeah.
I
hope they don't get co-opted. I think that's the hope for everyone here.
Who's going to what's Andrea Arnold going to get, like, how's she going to sell out? You know, how's Maren Ade going to sell out?
In a way, I'd be interested in all of them, what their version of selling out would look like.
Well, I think that is a really good question.
Yeah.
I think we should start asking these people, like, ask Barry Jenkins, what's your idea of selling out? Like, what is a movie that you would consider making but probably wouldn't because it would make you feel like you had compromised yourself in some way?
For Ezra, it would be like making a 2-hour documentary.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It'd be really interesting to see what that was. Anyway, I gotta go because my car is here.
Okay, Wesley. Thank you so much for doing this. I hope you have a good Christmas.
Thank you. I hope you have a good Christmas. Enjoy Fresno.
I will. I'll see you in the new year.
Okay.
So long.
Bye.
Hey, it's Alyssa Wilkinson from Vox.com. So one thing that made me really, really happy this year was Donald Glover's show Atlanta, which I know made a lot of people really happy, but I just finished the finale yesterday, so I'm a bit behind people, but I think I just love the episodic nature of it. I love how it goes nowhere that I'm expecting. I loved every character on it. They made me happy when I saw them. And I just think that of all of the TV shows that I saw this year, it was the one that felt the most innovative and the funniest. And like it actually had something to say without sacrificing entertainment value or its own principles. So I'm very pleased with it. I can't wait to see another season of it. And I'm really glad that it happened this year. Happy holidays.
The last person we called for this Christmas holiday special that we're doing here is the actress Zazie Beetz. She was Van in the show Atlanta, which is something Matt and Alyssa and others have talked about as the art that continued to propel them forward in 2016. And for my money, it is the best piece of cinema I saw this year, whether it was in film or television. It didn't matter. It's an incredible, incredible show on FX. So if you have not seen that, definitely seek it out. In this call that I had with her, we talked about 1984, Down and Out in Paris and London, and then just tried our best to do some sort of year overview / general sentiments about how the 12 months have gone. It is depressing. It is hopeful. It is sad. It is happy. It is everything you hope in a conversation, I think. So I thank Zazie for taking the time, and I hope you enjoy this.
I'm with David's family in Minnesota right now, and we're out in a hike in the middle of the woods in the snow, and we lost one of the brothers, and it's because his brother
You lost one of them?
No, well, we like went ahead and we're like, where's Gabe? And he just went through a big breakup, and the girlfriend called today, so I was just relaying the message. Anyway, hi.
Hi. Wow. Immediately, as per usual, let's get into the thick of it. There's no time to waste to talk about the emotional turmoil of the breakup.
But it's been really great, and this is my third time being here with his family. And I'm feeling, honestly, like the most comfortable I've ever felt, which is really nice. So, you know, getting like folded in more and more. So I like that.
And you guys are like, you said you're going to church.
Yeah, we're going to go later tonight, and then we're going to go, I think, twice tomorrow.
Oh, my God.
And then
three times?
We head to Minneapolis. Yeah, yeah. And then we head to Minneapolis to do some more celebrations. And then David and I head out because we're then going to fly to Germany for the new year. So it's going to be a bunch of traveling, and then we go to L.A. So,
that's right.
Yeah, that's when we go through the Golden Globes. We'll be there. So it's gonna be a bunch, but it's really nice.
Yeah.
It's nice to like get out. But you're in Fresno.
I'm in Fresno right now. Yeah.
Is your whole family there?
My mom is, yeah. And brothers and friends. And I'm here for the week. And then I go I'm going to Vegas for one night.
Oh, why?
I've never been like of age.
Are you going by yourself?
No. I'm going with a friend who's turning 21.
Okay. Well, that'll be fun.
You sound not psyched about that idea for me.
No, I think that'll be fun. I always think of my cousin. She always wants to go to Vegas for her birthday every year, and then it never happens. So, I've never been. I'm not like a gambler, though. So
that's good. By the way, that's a good thing. That's for sure a good thing.
Are you gonna go to gamble? Or are you gonna go like for the shows?
There's no way I'm not gonna gamble. I am kind of a gambler, but I've been on hiatus this whole year.
Yeah. Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
You just like set aside the money. You know.
Yeah, you have to be okay with losing X amount and then hope you win, but be okay with be comfortable.
Yeah.
It's stupid. It's so dumb. But you know what?
Oh, what do you like to gamble with? Or like what's the thing that you like?
I like blackjack, and I like a game called Texas Hold'em. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Mm. That's poker, right?
it's just poker. Yeah. There's no point in going into specifics if you don't play. But yeah.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful thing in a way.
Yeah. I took my dad to a casino this year. We're doing a road trip, and I took him to his first casino, and we played some blackjack, and we won. We won like $15. Yeah.
Every time it's the first time, it's kind of like a drug. It's always free the first time. It's terrible because then you win, and then you think, oh, this is what it's gonna be, and then it's not.
Well, because you're going like purely on instinct and not on skill or strategy at all. So you probably end up doing the riskier thing, maybe.
So that means instinct is better than developed skill.
Well, we made it this far on something. I don't know, man. I've been up impressing family. Trying to. But that's so you don't even really have like a, is it cold in Fresno?
Yeah, it's like 47.
Oh, okay.
That's fine.
Yeah, that's not bad.
So do you want to talk about one thing or many things or whatever you want? We didn't talk about what you wanted to talk about. Was there something specific?
Well,
we can go over a few things. That's fine.
Okay. I'll tell you the first thing that pops into my head, which is what popped into my head the last time we talked, which was reading 1984. And I guess there's always...
You're smiling. You're really laughing nice and smiling while saying this.
It's such a good book. I mean, there's something I think really nice about picking up a classic and recognizing why it's a classic. In terms of just like the quality of story and the quality of writing and like communicating. I felt sort of moved by the support of the masses, or not of the masses, but of like The Lowest Man. And I started reading this other book of his called Down and Out in Paris and London, which is a semi-autobiographical, and or it kind of is autobiographical, it is, about his time when he was down and out in Paris and London, and essentially, you know, like living on like a dollar a day and stuff like that. And, you know, when you reach the bottom and you realize it's not as bad as you thought it could be. And I liked this like depiction of, it feels like this voice for people who don't usually have their voices heard. And I don't know how to say that in a way that's like not cliche. But kind of the strength that we also have, you know, that these are the true problems and yet we continue to thrive and continue and just sort of continue. And the sort of intelligence behind it and the recognition that, you know, somebody understands that, you know, this was a reality 100 years ago. And in ways like, you know, it's a moving, 1984 is a moving story because we're seeing it replicated again right now in a way. And to sort of the reconnaissance is something that is so timeless and harrowing, but that, you know, we're not all just like blindly following like somebody, and in this case George Orwell, I suppose, is like trying to make us see. And I don't know, I just really liked that. I liked it. So I don't know if that really makes any sense.
That made a lot of sense.
I loved that book. It
did.
I'm trying to capture the feeling that I had, and it makes me feel like I'm just sort of rambling.
Mm-hmm.
But especially reading Down and Out in Paris and London, I think from a standpoint of like struggling emotionally on a day-to-day basis, it just makes you, I don't know if it's a thing of putting into perspective. You know, there are other things that could be amiss within life, and I'm fortunate enough to not have to encounter those.
Mm.
And for many people, those are things that are day-to-day reality, like literally not eating and stuff like that. And, you know, I think that's like the classic sort of recognition of I still have privilege in many ways, and that I should be thankful for what I have. So I don't know, but that's, I guess it's one thing.
It also seems like within those, it seems like you're talking about like how both are showing life then, but also how it's repeating itself now, which is like the which is the most terrifying or strange thing about reading something like that, is you think, my God, sometimes I think it's, I mean, this is cliche to say, but I always worry, like, have we just not changed at all? Like, have we pretty much stood still? It's very concerning.
Yeah. I mean, I guess our mental abilities, I guess, only go so far, you know?
Hmm.
And like, have we, I suppose, reached our limit for empathy, or, you know, or are we not going to get beyond? I also feel like, I don't know if we talked about this the last time, but I wonder if things sort of repeat as the generation that had experienced it before dies off, because people aren't really there to sort of remind us as actively of like what to, I don't know, quote unquote, look out for.
Yeah.
So I don't know. People keep comparing Hitler to the Holocaust. I mean, I'm sorry. People keep comparing Trump to Hitler.
Mm.
And, you know, is this going to be the Holocaust again? And it's sort of, it's maybe not funny, but it's just like happening again. as the victims of this and the people who experience this are running out. And, you know, and so that's sort of like, I don't know, makes me think that. But I also think that our generation is actually trying to be very open and is trying to be loving. And, you know, a lot of our political, maneuvering right now globally is being conducted by older people. So I don't know. Everyone in my circle is very loving.
That same applies in my circle too. But then it seems the farther we get out of the circle, I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, it's funny. I don't think either of us want things to be homogenous. Like, I don't need everyone to be the same. But if we could just all agree on like some sort of shared empathy and understanding, or just sort of a, I don't know, maybe a common ethic. I don't even, it's just so bizarre. It's a strange.
Yeah.
It's a strange time.
It seems pretty self-evident. You know, what is important and what isn't important to me, you know, in terms of accepting one another and like no slave labor and don't rape people. And, you know, that all makes sense to me. And of course, there will be isolated instances of things like this, because whatever, mental illness and all kinds of things exist. But it also, I also understand like complexity, and I understand, you know, like, David's mother is pro-life, which I can understand where she's coming from in terms of, she literally thinks upon conception, it's a baby and that you are killing a baby. And so like, what do you do? Like, that's like, if you truly believe like abortion is murder, how do you not fight for that baby? You know what I mean?
Of
and
course.
So I don't know. I don't know what's right in that situation. I personally don't think until it's like become a fetus that it has any type of, like, I feel like having an abortion, obviously it's not the same, but I feel like if you take that clump of cells out of your body, it's like, oh, I got a scratch, or like I clipped my nail. It's not the same thing, but it, you know, to me, that's sort of what I don't recognize it as a baby. And so, you know, I understand that complexity. I also understand the complexity of like going in as a leader of millions and millions of people. And it's not going to be, it's just not easy. You know, you're trying to align everyone's belief, and that's just never going to happen. So it's always going to be compromised, but, you know, in certain things there shouldn't be, I don't know.
Yeah. It feels, it's tough.
Yeah.
It's so tricky. It's so tricky.
I don't know if that's truly like uplifting. I think I just felt sort of, I think honestly, maybe my biggest takeaway from like 1984 was just, it's this beautiful literature, you know, and what a, you know, a blessing to read a good book in a way.
Yeah. Last thing I want to ask you before we go, how do you feel about next year? Are you someone at like, new, do you make resolutions in the new year, or what is your approach?
I kind of, not seriously. But that's because I kind of view, for me, every day is sort of a new beginning. And I focus more on that than on the beginning of a year. And so I kind of try to renew myself every day and to begin every day with a new foot. And I sort of think of sleep as like, I'm shutting down and waking up like to another opportunity again. But I suppose, like, I have a couple of things, and the biggest thing that I think encompasses a lot is having faith. And I think that means both in people and in trusting and I find I am unhappy when I don't just sort of trust, which I have to say a lot of feeling sort of perpetually sad or upset has broken down my ability to trust sort of anything and makes me more sad and upset. And, you know, and has sort of, I think, provided this like state of disillusionment from, you know, is there like hope or is there spirituality or is there any of that? And I don't really speak of faith in like a God sense, but in like a forward with positivity and hope sense in a way. And I think to, embody that. Cause I find, the people I know who are old and have had life happen to them and have had awful things happen, the survivors are the ones who remained positive. and you know, I talked to my grandmother about that, and she's in the hospital literally every other week without hyperbolizing. Like every 2 weeks, I basically get a call from my mother that she's in the hospital. And she's just, her spirit is just always just so alive. And I feel like it saved her life. And I see how my spirit now, and I'm so young, I see how it's taking away from my life when I become wrapped up in negativity. And that's not who I recognize and who I identify with as being myself. I feel sort of like I've been robbed. And so I want to sort of re-embrace that and to think of continuation and Yeah, I also kind of always have, like, anytime I make a wish or something, I always sort of wish for freedom. And I think of, like, freedom of the heart, freedom of fear, and having a family, but maybe not next year. But, you know, that's something I always want.
I feel like you're doing a good job on all those fronts.
I guess talking about it, right, talking about it is good. I can give you more positive things, maybe.
I think that was lovely. I thought that was great.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
I thought, look, you know what I was thinking?
I didn't know if I really had a point.
No, you had a point, but that's a thing that happened. I think a few of my friends have that where, actually Mackenzie, who came on the podcast, also does this thing where they go on long tangents like you just did. And at the end, you both say, like, I don't know if that had a point. And I saw the point so clearly. I thought that was nice. And also, just thinking about, like, concrete, you know, I think you have been moving forward. I think we both have.
Yeah, I think so, too.
You know, I think that's even in the wake of all that's happened. From even from the last phone when we talked, like, a couple of weeks ago. You know, I think we're doing the best we can. And
can I read you a quote from Down and Out in Paris in London?
Of course, do that, because that's exactly what you did on the podcast. Do you remember when you read?
that last quote. I remember. Was it an Elizabeth? No. That was from. I remember which one it was.
Yeah.
But this one I think might apply to like how we could maybe view this year. And in a way of like, it could only go up.
Okay, by the way, this is how I want from now on every episode of the podcast to end, is you reading a quote from something you love.
It's maybe not as profound, but I liked it. Okay. It is a feeling of relief, almost of pleasure, knowing yourself at last genuinely down and out. You have talked so often of going to the dogs, and well, here are the dogs, and you have reached them, and you can stand it. It takes off a lot of anxiety. That's it.
That was nice.
Yeah. Okay.
get that.
And I can sort of relate to that. And so maybe next year is like...
Yeah, the next year. I feel like maybe we can all just put a... Just maybe close the book on these last 12 months. I think we've had enough. I think that's it. We're done.
Yeah, yeah.
We can move forward now.
Yeah. I think so, too.
It's not... But then it's like, you know, it's not like going to magically get better. But I think we all know what we have to do. Or at least we all know we have to do something. Maybe we don't know what that is.
Yeah.
But I do think we all know we have to do something.
Yeah, I agree. I agree. Even if it starts from within. Plant the seed within yourself.
Plant the seed within yourself. Look, that's inspiring. That's nice. Okay. Do you want to go back to the family now?
Yeah, I probably should. I'm wandering outside the house. But it was really nice talking as usual.
Yeah, it was good. Do you know that I've been pronouncing your name wrong for the whole time?
This is terrible, and maybe it's like I should respect myself more. I just don't hear it really anymore, just because the amount of times I have to correct people, I just respond. So yeah, Zassi, Zassi,
Zassi.
That's how you say it. Yeah,
I'd want to get that pronunciation right.
Zassi. So the second Z sounds like an S, and there's an inflection on the C. Zassi.
Zassi. Like that?
Yeah, Zassi.
Well, I was...
And you're Sam, right?
No, actually, I've been meaning to tell you, it's not quite pronounced that way.
the first S the sounds S is, like... Samuel Fergoso.
That's right. Yeah.
That's right. Do you have a middle name?
Sebastian.
Samuel Sebastian.
Yeah. What's your middle name?
Olivia.
Olivia?
Yeah.
It seems oddly surprising to me. I don't know why.
Well, my mom kind of wanted me to have a more normal sounding middle name in case my first name didn't really work out well for me.
Okay. Well,
yeah,
it worked out.
It worked. Yeah, it did work, surprisingly. Honestly, though, it's actually really, it is kind of a strange name, and I've never had issues, which is great. But that's the pronunciation.
That's a good name. This was good. I'll talk to you later. I got to send you that gift.
All right. I'm going to go.
Okay. I'll see you soon.
Bye. It was great hearing your voice.
Of course.
Bye, Sam.
So long. Bye-bye. This is generally the segment of the show when I say those who've enjoyed it should review it on iTunes so as to help us reach new listeners. This is true. It's indisputably true. But I'm not going to make the pitch today. Instead, I'm just going to say thank you. Thank you for listening. Thank you for being here, especially those who have been here since our launch in April or those who just started listening. It means the world that we have a growing audience and people who have responded so positively to the show and what we're trying to do. It's something not talked about enough publicly, but I think when you start an endeavor that's independent of a larger entity or something funding it or someone funding it, as we did and still are independent, it's scary. It's scary because on a week-to-week basis, you are wondering to yourself and everyone else who's working on this show, is what we're doing important? Is it significant? Does it matter? Why are we continue doing something that we are not getting paid to do? It's a question I've asked myself every week. And the answers vary from week to week, depending on how enthusiastic I am. And the enthusiasm wanes and oscillates back and forth, as it always does. But the support we have received from people who have listened and responded, it really does help us continue onward. And I know that's generic or cliche or is a given, but I want those listening to know that you listening right now, hopefully there's more than four, but you understand what I'm saying. You make it work. You make us work. You make this show continue. And there have been a lot of people who've helped us out. Some people I want to mention real quick. Dom at Paste and Rebecca at the AV Club, who both wrote continuously throughout this year nice things about the podcast. Our friend Nathan Heller at The New Yorker. My pal Steve Green at IndieWire. Max Linsky at Longform. Josh Spiegel, Tina Hassania, and Kenji Fujishima at Movie Mezzanine, who really, without their hard work at Movie Mezzanine, I would have not been able to spend as much time as I did on this podcast. So I owe them. My friends Harrison, Quinn, Kyle, Jamie, Phil, Cassidy, Garrett, Corey, Nikki V, Claire, and Zach, and Kalyan, and Meta Marie, and so many more people I am not including, and you know who you are. Thank you for being patient with me as your friend when I responded 37 minutes late to your text or called you back the next day because I spent too much time on this podcast. Mom and Dad, my brothers and sister, they had to put up with my shit on a daily basis or on a semi-daily basis, and they do. And I don't know why they do, but I'm thankful for it. And, you know, of course, lastly, none of this happens without the music by Vanilla, our friend from the UK, our executive producer David Chen, graphics by Ian Jones, our illustrations by Krishna Shenoy, our social media by Maria Mayella. Our new associate producer is going to be helping us out more in the new year, Nora Knight. Lastly, Coriatad, who has produced and edited every single episode of this podcast since we started. The show would not exist without him. And I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you so much for listening to Talk Easy over these last 9 months. Happy holidays to you, and I'll see you next year.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.